Welcome to Tuesday, not Monday, the day after Memorial Day, May 30th. I'm Bill Radke, host of KUOW's The Record. I'm glad you've tuned in today. We are live tweeting at KUOW. In the news today, our top story is that the suspect in a double homicide on a Portland light rail train will be charged today. Again, two men were killed when they stepped in to confront Jeremy Christian after he threatened two female passengers, one of them wearing a hijab, a headscarf. Let's get the latest now from Portland. Beth Hyams is an editor at OPB News. Beth, thank you for joining us.
Hi, you're welcome.
What is our latest understanding of what happened on that train?
Well, as you said, a man was abusing two teenagers who were on the train with just a range of rhetoric, insulting and racist rhetoric. A number of witnesses have spoken out about what they saw. And so these three men stepped forward to defend the girls. And as you said, two of them were killed.
Do we know how they stepped in, whether they physically stepped in or just said, hey, leave her alone, or what happened?
Yeah, apparently at the beginning it was more verbal. I think they did stand up and move toward him and said, hey, you can't talk, you know, these are just girls. You can't talk to them like that. You can't be that way. And I think he just continued the insults. And as these men got close enough to him, obviously, they were in range to be slashed. And it all happened extremely quickly. And one man, Rick Best, died there on the train. The second man who died, Talesian Namkai Meche, was a recent Reed College graduate. He died at the hospital after. And the third man, Micah Fletcher, was seriously wounded, also slashed at the neck. He fortunately survived, and he's now been released from the hospital.
Now, there is a recording of a man making threats on a MAX train in Portland the day before the attack, and police say the voice you're about to hear appears to be this attacker, Jeremy Christian.
Oh, it's like we got a Christian or Muslim bus driver, I'll stab you too, bitch. Move forward. Move forward, MAX driver, f*** you. I'm about to stab somebody. Call the police. I dare you.
What do we know about this suspect and why he might have done this?
Well, he's a kind of a familiar face to the police and to reporters as well, because he made a scene at an earlier protest this spring in Portland. He was pretty notable, draped in a flag and shouting some rhetoric of the sort that we've just heard on that recording. As far as a motive goes, there's no way to know. The speech is filled with hateful remarks about all kinds of people. Jeremy Christian does have a criminal record for some other violent crimes. He served time in prison, but there's no way of knowing what might have prompted this attack on Friday.
We're talking with editor Beth Hyams at OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting News. This man is in court today. What's he going to be charged with?
Oh, it's multiple counts of murder. There's two counts of aggravated murder, attempted murder, intimidation in the second degree, and being a felon having a restricted weapon. And then a grand jury will be convened, and they're expected to consider some additional charges, too.
What about a hate crime?
Well, that intimidation charge that I mentioned is Oregon's equivalent of a hate crime, and I think that just remains to be seen where that goes.
How are people in Portland talking about these three bystanders who stepped in, as you told us, to stop this man from harassing two young women on a train?
Well, I think the city and, in fact, the nation is overwhelmed by the actions of these three men, that they apparently stepped forward. None of them knew one another, we don't think, and none of them knew the girls, as far as we know. And yet they just immediately jumped up to try to defend these girls. And there's a lot of talk in the community about who among us would really do that when someone was belligerent, spouting hateful things, and, you know, would we be too frightened to stand up the way these three men did?
Yeah. Who among us? That's exactly what we're going to talk about in just a moment, Beth. Finally, I just want to know about this issue of some right-wing groups in Portland wanting to hold a so-called free speech rally next month. The suspect was at a similar rally in April. The mayor of Portland now says he wants to cancel this upcoming rally in response to what's happened. What can you tell us is the latest with that situation?
Well, it's not really up to the mayor to cancel them. The square where the rally is planned is it's permitted by the federal government. So Mayor Ted Wheeler has asked the federal government to revoke the permit. The ACLU of Oregon immediately jumped in yesterday and said that that's not legal, that these groups, even if they have unpopular beliefs or beliefs that Mayor Ted Wheeler thinks could be disruptive to civic life in Portland, they still have their free speech rights like anyone does. And so the ACLU has suggested that the mayor ask the groups to either cancel or postpone their events. The mayor had mentioned that he might, in fact, do that. But the ACLU pointed out that when he called for the revocation of the permits, that kind of garnered all the attention.
Okay, we'll see about that. Again, this so-called free speech rally is scheduled in Portland for June. And we've been talking with Beth Hyams about what happened over the weekend. Beth is an editor at OPB News. And thanks for catching us up, Beth.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to KUOW's The Record. And you heard Beth talk about that. Who among us? Right? Who steps in a situation like that and who doesn't? Because as you and I both know, this isn't the first time we've heard about somebody yelling racial insults at a public place. In fact, something similar happened last year here at a Starbucks in Seattle. A couple of African-American educators were having coffee, Yoshiko Harden and Bob Hughes. And Yoshiko told us what happened. And I want to warn you here, there's some very strong language.
It was about 10:30. We were about a half hour into our meeting, and I felt something warm on my face and my forearms, and I thought that someone had tripped and spilled their drink, their warm drink. And so I looked over, and there was a young white male looking at me, and can you swear on radio?
We can try.
Okay. So, and I looked at him, and he said, you know, "F-ing nigger bitch." And I kind of stopped, and it was at that point I realized it was spit on my face and hands, that he had spit on me. And then he kind of wound up to do it again and spit again and got on me again. And for sure, at that point, I saw that it got on Bob and got on his coat. And then he yelled again and just kind of casually walked out. I got up to get some napkins. And he stood at the window and was yelling. We couldn't hear him, but assume he was yelling around the same language, same thing. My first thought was, do I know him? And then I thought, he's going to kill me.
Okay, so imagine you're in that Starbucks on Capitol Hill or wherever. You've got a choice to make, don't you? What am I going to do in this situation? Well, except for one woman, a white woman who alerted the store manager, those patrons on that day chose to do nothing.
Nobody approached us. Nobody looked at us. Nobody talked to us. It was as if the incident didn't happen.
And this was a mixed race crowd or all white,
yeah,
or who was there?
It was a mixed race crowd. So it was very diverse. There were other black people in the Starbucks and there were other black women. There were white people. I mean, it was a regular busy morning, people on their devices, people coming in and out.
And what did it say to you that there was so little reaction?
That it wasn't important, that, you know, something that had really changed my life didn't show up as meaningful or impactful.
Bob and Yoshiko told me that they did not expect customers to confront their attacker. They're saying, just be helpful, call a police officer, or just ask us, are you okay?
If you hear something like that, you need to say, what's going on here? Is this something that does concern me? Because frankly, it was. This is a public space in which somebody assaulted two people. And if you allow that to happen as a member of a community, then what do you want from your community? What happens when it happens to you? Do you want somebody to be there to at least pay attention to the fact that you're being assaulted?
Thanks to Bob Hughes and Yoshiko Harden for telling us their story. So this incident at this Starbucks last year, nobody did anything. Almost no one helped at all during or after this assault. That phenomenon has a name. They call it the bystander effect, the phenomenon of people not helping someone in need when others are around. Professor Cheryl Kaiser is with the University of Washington Psychology Department. She studies the bystander effect. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
Why don't people step in?
Well, it's the size of the crowd. When we're in a large crowd, oftentimes when we encounter kind of hateful rhetoric like's just been described here, I think a lot of people's first reaction is to freeze. They look at the people around them. They're all freezing too. And what we do sometimes is read from the faces of others who are inactive that maybe this isn't a problem. Maybe somebody else will step in. So ironically, the larger the group gets, the less likely any one individual is to stand up and do something about it.
Well, that is often a reason that people look around and do nothing. Then there's the fear of exactly what happened in Portland. If I step in, I could get hurt too. I've got, you know, whatever it is, I've got loved ones. What do you make of, how prevalent do you think that sometimes reasonable fear is in people doing nothing?
Yeah, I think that fear is a reasonable one that's out there for people. I think the Portland incident was at the far end of the extreme in terms of the clear and imminent danger where these men stood up to protect people from hate. Oftentimes the situations may be subtler, less dangerous, but we still see this. It might be in an office place where somebody expresses a bigoted remark and nobody says anything, and the fear of harm is less central there, but oftentimes you still see the same type of inaction.
Right. That's the kind of thing that's maybe much more likely to happen to us regularly.
Right.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you saw about what happened in Portland where people did step in and suffered physically for it. Two people are dead. How did you react to that?
Well, you know, first as a human, it's tragic. And then second, as a psychologist who looks at these issues, and we think about these men becoming what we call active bystanders, kind of having the moral courage to step forward, something we think about in across history and across time. People who stood up and rescued Jews during the Holocaust, for example. There are people who are kind of shining examples of what it means to be active. And what will that effect have on people who see bystanders? Will it inhibit their future behavior? Will they think, well, if this happens, I shouldn't do it? Or will it inspire them and say, let's change the norms? If we start to stand up together, other people will follow.
What a great question. Will this inhibit people or inspire people? You study these things. Do you have an opinion about that?
I think in today's political climate, many people are starting to kind of polarize in terms of where do they stand. And one place where these three men stood was on fighting bigotry and identifying as kind of moral, courageous people who care about justice, who have a multicultural identity. And when they see people in their in-group, these young women being harassed, they're going to stand up and do something about it because it starts to affect their group, people they care about, people they include as part of what it means to be American. And I think very much it will inspire people.
You're talking about the political climate now, Professor. You know, after Donald Trump was elected, the Southern Poverty Law Center and ProPublica started this project of documenting instances where people experienced or just witnessed racist or sexist harassment or attack. And that's natural for us to wonder whether the political climate is related to individual incidents like the one in Portland. Do you have any thoughts about what's a helpful way to think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sure, these things will, when they do happen, you're going to have variation in how people behave in a given situation. We know a little bit about the backgrounds of these men who stood up, including one, for example, who there's video of him talking about kind of fighting bias through poetry, and others like kind of were people who cared about justice for the long haul. This was part of who they were and stepping in. But the political climate makes that all the more salient. And as kind of these two sides in politics polarize, we're going to see people start to stand up for their beliefs, and those beliefs are ingrained in who they are and their identities. And for the men in this situation, as well as others like them, if resistance to kind of the anti-immigrant and anti-minority rhetoric that's been prevalent in the current campaign and climate starts to become part of who they see themselves as resistors, we should see more standing up to bias.
University of Washington psychology professor Cheryl Kaiser, can I bounce one more thing off you, an idea of how to react to an incident like this?
Sure thing.
The idea is that you walk up to the victim, somebody being harassed, maybe you sit next to them, and you engage them in conversation, and you're ignoring the attacker. I have a snippet of a video along these lines that BuzzFeed put up explaining why you would do this, and you would just pretend the attacker is not even there.
It's based on a psychological concept called non-complementary behavior. Basically, if someone's being aggressive towards you, you want to be as unaggressive towards them as possible and diffuse the situation.
I'm Cassie. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Step two, pick a topic, whatever you want to talk about. Could be the weather, could be a show you just saw on Netflix. You're just trying to make a safe space for the person.
So I just started this show on Netflix. It's called Stranger Things, and it is so good. Have you seen it before?
Yeah.
Step three, keep building that safe space. If you want to make the attacker feel irrelevant and ignored, it'll make them want to leave.
You want the attacker to feel irrelevant or ignored, and you want to make them want to leave. And then if the aggressor won't leave, the idea is to see if you can get the victim to leave with you, go to a neutral space, go to a different part of the train or the bus. And BuzzFeed got this idea from an online cartoon that went viral last year. It was drawn by a French woman after she saw Muslims being harassed and attacked in Paris. What do you think about this idea of, what do they call it, non-complimentary behavior?
It's provocative. Will it work? I don't know. It would certainly, I think, throw an attacker off guard when all of a sudden their behavior is being intercepted by someone completely distracting the conversation and taking it somewhere else. It seems like a reasonable strategy. Of course, we all walk around with our cell phones in ways to contact the police and intervene, for example, too. So it might be the case that you have someone with you. You call the police. I'm going to step in here so that you have some protection as you start to do that and have multiple strategies going. I think once people learn about this bystander effect, it's one of the strongest predictors of whether or not they'll step in and do something.
That's why we're glad you've come on and told us about this, Professor. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Professor Cheryl Kaiser, UW Psychology Department, telling you about the bystander effect, why people often don't step in when you think they might, and what it would take to turn people from, as she said, inhibited to inspired to act. In fact, we're going to tweet out a link to that cartoon that I described, drawn by that French woman. So you can join us on Twitter at KUOW and get an idea of how you might respond. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You know, we've just been talking about this double homicide on a Portland light rail train over the weekend, and I'd like to ask you about this. Have you seen hate speech? Have you been targeted by hate speech? What did you do about it? Tell us your story. You can email us at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. You can call us. Leave a message, 206-221-3663. 221-3663. We were talking about when people feel inhibited versus inspired, and maybe you can inspire somebody. 221-3663. Elsewhere in the news today, we're talking about the new budget proposal from the White House. The 2018 proposal called for a change in the law to pressure local police to enforce federal immigration policies, including the detainer requests that the federal government can put on local governments, detainer requests to keep undocumented immigrants. Well, Seattle has sued the Trump administration over its threats to remove federal funding for so-called sanctuary cities. Some local law enforcement agencies are especially concerned that some police jobs could even be on the line. For example, in Auburn, just south of Seattle, a federal grant helps pay for one out of every 10 officers. White House officials have threatened to cut grants like those to places that don't fully cooperate with immigration enforcement. Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team takes us on a police ride-along in a suburb wrestling with the administration's threats about funding.
Four out of 50, he can send me to that as well.
Police officer Aaron Williams furrows his brow as he reroutes toward a 911 call.
This call is just a little bit weird, so...
We cruise through Auburn, a suburb just south of Seattle, where the Latino population has more than doubled in the past decade. Williams has worked here 17 years, and he recently took a new role on the community response team. A big part of his job is to create closer ties with the people who live and work here.
And specifically down here at 25th and F, in this area, is a large Hispanic community. So we're trying to kind of understand, okay, so what's the best way to connect with them? You know, is it through Facebook? Is it more, you know, community meetings, bike patrol guys being down here and us being out on foot?
Auburn's community response team has grown to 3 officers in the past couple years, thanks to a federal COPS grant. COPS is short for Community Oriented Policing Services. Auburn's been awarded $2 million from this fund in the past 5 years. But it's one of the police grants that Trump officials have threatened to cut from sanctuary cities. Sanctuary's a fuzzy term. It generally refers to policies that restrict information sharing or the use of local resources for immigration enforcement.
Somebody called 911?
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did. Okay, let me pull over here. You guys okay?
Yeah.
We arrive at the 911 call. An 11-year-old boy had reported his twin sister was missing, and a dozen kids cluster on the sidewalk. It turns out the sister is fine. 2 more cops roll up on bicycles, and the kids, all immigrants from the Marshall Islands, surround them like paparazzi and fire off questions.
You have a gun?
I do.
Yes, I do. I have a gun.
And you guys gonna kill people?
No, absolutely not.
Some of these kids have seen the bike cops around and challenged them to a race. A few parents look on from the apartment steps. As we head back to the station, Officer Williams says he'd love to see the bike patrol expand because they get to know a lot of people. The COPS grant pays for these bike officers, too. In fact, it pays for about 10% of Auburn's police staff.
Well, that's a big deal for us.
This is Auburn Police Commander Steve Stalker. He's managed these COPS grants and doesn't think his department's policies on immigration should put this money at any risk.
We never have and never will. We don't actively go out and look for illegal immigrants. However, if the federal government does contact us and come into Auburn with an active case and they ask for our assistance, we will assist them. That's law enforcement assisting law enforcement.
Stalker says officers don't ask about immigration status. Auburn's policy also says it's unnecessary to notify ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement when someone is booked into jail or hold people in jail extra time while ICE investigates, unless there's a warrant or criminal charge. One of President Trump's executive orders aims to withhold money from places that hinder ICE, and it's raised questions about what criteria the feds will use to define these so-called sanctuary locations. It's unclear if Auburn's policies fall into this category. But what is clear is that U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants more cooperation across the board, as he indicated at a March press conference.
But fundamentally, we intend to use all the lawful authority we have to make sure that our state and local officials who are so important to law enforcement are in sync with the federal government.
Sessions also noted that $4 billion in law enforcement grants is at stake, including that COPS program that Officer Williams is a part of. Several cities, including Seattle, have filed lawsuits challenging this executive order and to seek clarity on the legal limits of cooperation between local police and ICE. In Seattle, the loss of these police grants would be a small drop in a big budget, and city officials have taken a high-profile stand in the fight over sanctuary cities. But in suburban Auburn, the city council is moving cautiously about whether to adopt this label.
I don't support the word sanctuary city because of the funding issues.
This is Auburn's deputy mayor, Largo Wales, at a council meeting in May.
But I do think that we need to take it up a couple of notches, and we need to go to an ordinance.
The city council is debating an ordinance that would strengthen sanctuary policies, including more explicit wording that city staff don't ask about immigration status. But there's hesitation to hoist this flag higher and potentially draw scrutiny from the feds. Auburn resident Vidal Rojas, choking back tears, encouraged the council to act.
Que estamos gastando nuestro tiempo, que están ahí sentados ustedes muy cómodos y nosotros podríamos...
Why are we wasting our time here? And you guys are sitting here really comfortable and we're all here putting all our energy into this.
Rojas said he wants children growing up here to know they're supported. This tug of war over federal funding for things like bike cops in suburban neighborhoods is set to continue in court, in Congress, and in cities across the country, whether they label themselves the sanctuary or not. I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
And a quick update on that story. The Auburn City Council has since passed a resolution that prohibits city employees from asking about a person's immigration status. Many community members had pushed for a stronger ordinance that would make that policy legally enforceable. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. New approaches to homelessness, and we're giving you a fighting chance to get into what could be a massively popular art installation coming to Seattle. Stay tuned. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Earlier this month, the city of Seattle swept a group of RV campers out from under the West Seattle Bridge. Rebecca Massey was one of those people living under the bridge. Now she is in a city-sanctioned encampment in Soto. Rebecca, thanks for coming in and telling us your story.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
When the city cleared out the RV camp where you were living, you weren't sure about moving into the city-sanctioned camp. Why is that?
Right. I've been under the Seattle Bridge with the same people, and we kind of developed a community under there, and we kind of felt like we should stick together as a community. I mean, we kind of got to know each other, and it's safety in numbers. We kind of looked out for each other, and so...
How did you do that for each other?
Well, like, people would watch my tent when I would go somewhere, and when we went to the food bank, sometimes people would cook community meals for more than one person, and so, you know, we would all sit around, we'd build a campfire and sit around it and eat and, you know, have community, fellowship, and it was kind of, you know, uplifting to have that, you know, because being homeless is pretty scary and pretty lonely sometimes, so it's kind of nice to be able to fellowship with people, and I didn't want to lose that.
Yeah. What made you decide to go to the city-sanctioned spot?
I mean, I've been swept four times now. I've only been in Seattle for about 9 months, and in those 9 months, I've been asked to move four times as a homeless person, and I was just ready to have some stability. I mean, that's what we're wanting all along, and I think if you talk to any homeless person, they're tired of being swept along, so...
What is that like to get? You could call it swept, or some people call it cleared, or just moved on. What's it like?
Well, it's kind of traumatic. I mean, you know, you have to pack up all your stuff and have a limited time to do it, and you don't really know where you're going to go because there's not a place to go. There's not, I mean, other than sanctioned camps or places the city has arranged, there's not a place to go. And sometimes people don't want to go to those tent cities because there's rules and there's expectations and there's the perceived loss of freedom.
Rebecca, would you mind telling me how you ended up without a place to live?
Well, I'm from Oklahoma. I drove here from Oklahoma, and I came here just seeking an opportunity to make some money. I didn't intend on being homeless. I know there's some perception that people come to Seattle seeking all the resources that they give to homeless people. I didn't come here anticipating receiving any of those services. I came here expecting to get a job and finding a place and saving up some money. And I had a van that I was going to travel around the country in. I had this glorious idea to live in a conversion van and travel around. And I have a art degree, and I was wanting to do art and travel around. And it didn't work out that way because my van got stolen. And so I wanted to save up some money and possibly buy another van or some way to continue that goal I wanted to accomplish.
I know this is such a huge question, but I think, you know, what was that like going from having this dream of going around in your van, selling your art, and then here you are living under the West Seattle Bridge? I mean, can you try to give us some idea what that's been like for you?
Well, it kind of spiraled down from there. I mean, it was, I didn't expect things to not go as planned, and it got increasingly hopeless. I mean, I spent a lot of lonely nights asking myself, what am I going to do? It's kind of scary, especially as a woman, to be on your own and not know where you're going to wind up. So it's pretty scary and pretty lonely to be homeless.
When you had been cleared out from under the West Seattle Bridge, did you know that you had another place to go, a city-sanctioned tent camp?
They offer those things on an individual basis, and not everyone that was in the community could go to the tent city that they were offering to me, because there's rules that you have to follow, and a lot of people are addicted to drugs and weren't able to be accepted into places like that. So I felt like I was leaving people behind.
You can't be addicted and be in the tent city?
No, in the Camp Second Chance where I am now, there's no drugs or alcohol. I mean, there's several rules that you have to follow and abide by to be a resident there.
How much have you found yourself missing that sense of community you talked about that you had under the West Seattle Bridge in that unsanctioned camp?
Well, I mean, I'm making new friends in the tent city I'm in now, and there are some really nice people there. I mean, don't get me wrong, I see the possibility of building a community there and feeling like I'm in a community there, but I just feel like I've left behind some people, and, you know, I just feel like I kind of let some people down because, you know, I kind of feel like I left them behind. And there's at least a couple people that have expressed that they're sad. I mean, you know, that they can't come to that tent city too. I mean, it's hard to not be around the people that I got to know. So, I mean, it's just a conflict because I feel bad for these people that are still there because they're going to be moved again. And it's just that ongoing feeling of unrest, I guess.
Yeah. Who are you thinking of?
I mean, there's Tiago, there's Mimi, there's Meg, there's Felicia, there's Matt. And they just, you know, they said, well, you know, we can't go there, you know. You're leaving us behind. And
they can't go because of the no drugs and alcohol or other?
Right,
that's
yeah.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the main thing is they're... Some of these people are addicted to drugs and they can't go. So
yeah, and you were close, and mm-hmm. they're struggling, and mm-hmm. and you moved.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like I want to, you know, have a place and, you know, have my own interests, but I feel like I'm being selfish too because these other people aren't getting their needs met, and I just feel like I could do more.
You know, Rebecca, so many of your friends are addicts, as you said. How do you think you were able to stay away from that? You said that some people get addicted to drugs after they're homeless because it grinds you down.
Mm-hmm.
How did you cope so well?
Well, I just made up my mind that I didn't want to go down that route. I just knew that wouldn't help me in any way, and I just had my goals in mind, and I just knew that getting on drugs, it was just not what I wanted to do and not the way I wanted to go. So, I mean, for me, I had already made up my mind. I just was not going to do drugs.
And you know, some people in homes say, yeah, now that's the kind of personal responsibility that all those homeless people need, and you deserve, you know, you're going to be okay, Rebecca, and you deserve it.
Well,
and some people don't.
I don't think that people are not undeserving of help because they're on drugs. I mean, those are probably the people that deserve more help, you know, being able to address those things. It's probably something the city should address more than spending money on sweeps, is maybe offering more services for people who are addicted to drugs.
So you were reluctant to go. You didn't like getting swept, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
But you went to this city-sanctioned camp, and you seem like you see a path for yourself. Does that make you feel any differently about the city going and moving people?
Well, I mean, I think that if there were more sanctioned camps for people that were still on drugs, and then maybe that was addressed at the camp, I mean, I think a lot more people would be helped instead of being swept. I mean, the city's not helping anybody by doing these sweeps. And it's actually, they're moving the same people around. It's not different homeless people. It's the same people are being moved to new spots. And they find a new spot and then they're moved from that spot. So I think having a place for all the homeless people to be able to stay in one spot would be a better solution than the sweeps.
Yeah, even though you're not on drugs, you're saying you'd like to see the city have more sanctioned encampments that they call low barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be for the immediate future. I think that's a better solution than spending all this money on sweeps. They're not accomplishing anything by doing these sweeps.
What about the public image of somebody who, you know, people who are homeless, they don't have to be if they had the will. There's some people who they don't want to be. They want to be homeless. They'd rather live without rules.
Well, that's a huge stigma and perception, and I think it's a fallacy. I mean, it's just until someone is homeless and is in that situation, I guess they won't understand. But I mean, it's not just a matter of, oh, well, they're just lazy, or they're not smart enough, or they made bad choices. I that's really unfair, I think, to reduce it to just, well, it's their fault they're homeless. It's not far-fetched for anybody to be homeless or be displaced from their home because they don't make enough money or some situation they're in because they got hurt or, you know, health problems and they lost their job. I mean, it's not so far-fetched. It's not so out there that, you know, it can't happen to people that don't think it's going to happen to them.
Well, Rebecca Massey, good luck with that dream. I hope you're in that van, if that's still where you want to be, selling your art or whatever your path is.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Massey is a resident of Camp Second Chance. It's a city-authorized homeless camp in SoDo. She moved there after the city swept the RV camp she was living in under the West Seattle Bridge. Many of those RVs are now setting up camp on some state-owned land in South Seattle. And the city says they plan to sweep that camp very possibly this week. Could happen on Thursday. This is KUOW Seattle, and here is another way that local cities are addressing homelessness. Tacoma has declared homelessness to be a state of public health emergency. And that is significant because it drives how Tacoma officials are approaching homelessness now. Instead of clearing out tent camps, the city has started providing portable toilets, hand washing stations, drinking water, and 24-hour security. Tacoma's mayor, Marilyn Strickland, joins us now. Welcome back, Mayor.
Thank you for having me.
Why is the city of Tacoma taking this more hands-on approach to addressing homelessness?
Well, we're taking on a more hands-on approach because what we've been doing has not been working. And I remind folks that if there were a solution to combating homelessness and finding a permanent way to address it, some city would have done it and they would have been successful. So one of the things we recognize is that people find themselves homeless for many different reasons, but at a minimum, we have to mitigate the human suffering and to bring people basic need, help them meet their basic needs. So, for example, it's why we're having the sanitation services, the porta potties, the running water, the showers, and then also having a trailer there that has access to folks who can offer social services, and then in addition to the security. Now, I want to make sure that we're clear here. We're not delivering these services because we want these encampments to be permanent. Our job here is to stabilize folks, to help them get their basic needs met, and to find a way to transition them out of these encampments into emergency shelters and hopefully short-term housing and long-term housing.
So you don't want these encampments to be permanent. Is there a time when these sanitation services or social services disappear?
Yes. When we set up these mitigation sites, we said we would be there from 4 to 6 weeks. And then after the six-week period is up, we fully intend to clean up the encampments. But while we're there for a month and a half, it gives us a chance to do a few things, as I mentioned earlier, to help folks get their basic needs met and to really do some outreach and find out from them what is it they need. Because one of the things that we're doing here, Bill, is we're collecting data to find out, you know, Are you employed? Because there are folks in encampments who actually are employed. Is it a driver's license? Is it, you know, a record that keeps them from being able to rent? You know, so what are some of the challenges they're facing, and how do we try to mitigate and address those while we're with them for 4 to 6 weeks, and then hopefully transitioning them to an emergency shelter or some type of transitional service? But this is not meant to be permanent. It's meant to be there for a finite period of time, because we do plan to clean out the encampments, but we want to do it in a way that's humane, that tries to help folks get connected to services.
You just described well these social services, what counselors like this can provide. I want to talk for a moment about just the sanitation services, the portable toilets, hand washing stations, drinking water. Is all of that aimed at just at making life more tolerable for the people in those encampments, or more tolerable for passersby? Or is there something more at work when you provide homeless people with that kind of sanitation?
Well, the declaration of a public health emergency was made because we saw encampments around town where people were literally living in filth. You had folks there who didn't have access to sanitation services. We had human waste. We saw people consuming food, and they were rodents. And so there was clearly a public health issue that was taking place. And we figured that instead of just going in there and just coming in there and just sweeping it out, let's go in there and offer the inhabitants the ability to get their basic needs met. And, you know, I tell people, I said, think about how you feel if you haven't had a shower for a few days. You don't exactly feel like facing the world. So imagine someone who's been living like that for a long period of time. So really just a way to show compassion, to get basic needs met, and to try to start the dialogue about how do we move you out of here to something that is temporary and safe, and then ideally long-term.
Finally, Mayor, talking with the mayor of Tacoma, Marilyn Strickland, we cities in this region, we're in conversation with each other. What do you want to say to a city like Seattle as it approaches homelessness, maybe in a way that's different from how you're going at it?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that is absolutely certain is that, you know, everyone is doing something really well, and everyone's probably doing something that leaves a lot to be desired. And what we want to do is learn from each other and figure out what's doing, what, you know, what goes well. But I think one thing that we know that is absolutely true in our region is that housing affordability is an issue, but every person who is homeless isn't homeless simply because they can't afford a place to live. There's so many other determinants, whether it's escaping domestic violence, not having access to identification, chronic health issues. And so we just have to make sure we take a holistic approach. And I think really, let's be realistic about it. I do not sit here and say that I'm going to eradicate homelessness, because for every person we help get housed, there's probably someone else coming right into the system. But how do we find a way to be compassionate, to be realistic, and to understand that enforcement has to be part of this? Because what we found is that there are some people in encampments who are doing drugs, and there are people who are selling drugs, and that is not acceptable. So we just have to take a very holistic approach with the understanding that we're not criminalizing homelessness, but we have to be realistic about how we approach this.
That's Tacoma Mayor Marilyn Strickland. Tacoma is taking a different approach. Instead of clearing out 10 camps for now, temporarily, the city is providing portable toilets, hand washing stations, drinking water, 24-hour security, and social services to go with that. Mayor Strickland, thanks for telling us about it.
All right, thanks for having me.
KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. There is an exhibit coming to Seattle Art Museum in June that's going to be so popular, we're not sure you can get in. At least we're giving you a fighting chance by telling you about it right now. We have KUOW's arts reporter Marcy Silman and Crosscut's managing editor Florangela Davila. Welcome to you both.
Hey.
Thanks.
Nice to see you again. So this is the artist Yayoi Kusama with her world-famous Infinity Mirrors exhibit. Florangela, why is this so popular that the Seattle Art Museum website says, due to high volume, our server is currently busy?
I know. It's harder to get these tickets than they were to get Beyonce tickets.
Why is that?
It is. I think people are really eager to escape. I mean, she is a badass artist. Apparently back there was a painting that was sold of hers, and she, at the time, Christie's sold it for the highest price ever for a female artist. She's been around a long time, and I think these infinity rooms, they allow you to escape. They allow you to experience what it might be like in outer space, or chaos, or what's it like when you close your eyes and you disappear into that world. And I think that is what's exciting, that you can see work by a living artist who is an avant-garde pioneer, groundbreaker here in Seattle.
I should say the museum says tickets are still available, but they're selling fast, and you may not be able to get at them if the server is busy and you have to hit refresh over and over. Okay, so good luck with that. Marcy Silman, will you tell us more about this artist, Yayoi Kusama?
Well, I was just saying to Florangela before we came in that I love to talk about 88-year-old badass women, to borrow your word. She came to Seattle, actually, first in 1957, born in Japan, moved here, and then went on to New York, where Yayoi was part of the sort of avant-garde pop world of the 60s and really came to fame doing these sort of happenings where she would cover nude people with polka dots and all over. It's New York, right? Polka dot theme continues. But a lot of those polka dots stem from the fact that she started hallucinating as a little girl. She hallucinates these images. And when she moved back to Tokyo in the 90s, sometime in the early 90s, she voluntarily checked herself into a mental institution. That's where she lives. She leaves and goes to her studio, but she lives in this mental institution.
Still today?
Yeah, still today.
Wow. So, Marcy, this exhibit was just in Washington, D.C. at the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden, and the museum director there said that the show has been transformative for the Hirshhorn, building its reputation as a national voice for contemporary art. Do you think Seattle can expect a similar reception?
I don't think it'll be quite the same at Seattle Art Museum. I think we have first of all, SAM is a museum of all forms. It can't just be specialized in one thing or the other. Seattle itself, I think, already has an international reputation as an art center. Maybe people who live here don't think about us that way, but other people in other parts of the world do, which is one of the reasons that this exhibition's coming to Seattle as opposed to going up to Vancouver, BC, or just going to Chicago and San Francisco.
Florangela, I'll ask both of you this, but Florangela, you were describing infinity mirrors a little bit. You walk into a room of mirrors with spectacular visuals like hanging lights or something rocketing around you infinitely. And I want to know, is this art or is this gimmick? Does it change your worldview? What do you think?
Oh, I think it's definitely art. I mean, I tend to like I have a diet of art. I like art that feels very real and maybe very personal, something that I might have experienced, and then something that blows my mind away. I mean, I think we, in this day and age, we're inundated with news headlines that may drive us crazy, and just, you just want to throw things, and you're angry, and you just want to lose it. And I think art is that form of escapism. I don't think it's gimmicky as much as it's a pathway. Mm. I think the thing I've heard too, though, is that you only have a set amount of time, and there's this notion of, do you spend that time taking selfies because you're seeing yourself, right? In infinity and infinity, and who doesn't want to see themselves over and over and over forever? So do you spend that time that you're in the exhibit taking selfies so that you can remember that? Or do you just put your cell phone away and just let the experience wash over you? That's kind of a moral dilemma. You only have a certain amount of time, and you can't, it's not going to be easy to go back and see the exhibit again.
I don't think any of us is going to be able to see it more than one time, given that we can't get through the server. I actually have my tickets, so I'm quite happy because they open it up if you're a SAM member.
Uh-huh.
They open it up to you first. So I had it on my calendar, and at 8 a.m. that day, it was like Beyonce tickets. But it is art in that sense that I think art is about changing the way you think about things. That's one thing that art does. So when you see yourself in a mirrored room, and I actually don't know how big these rooms are. I'm looking around our studio thinking maybe it's this size, it might be smaller. What do you think when you see the infinite? I mean, Bill, I'm sure that you were one of those little kids, I was, who laid on a hill and looked up at the stars and wondered, how far does this go? Well,
sure.
To infinity. This is the sort of contained version of that. That's art.
Okay. The infinite selfie. I'm going to meditate on that for a while. Okay. So you may or may not get tickets to Infinity Mirrors. I guess SAM is going to release some limited number of tickets each day, first come, first serve. Here's another show that you can see in Seattle.
I know that when my number's up, when I am called by God above, don't have my name inscribed into the store. Just say hey.
This is a musical about Imelda Marcos, wife of the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Florangela, how do you make a musical out of a regime that killed and tortured and imprisoned tens of thousands of people?
You do it very delicately and very thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. And I think actually this show delivers that. I was super...
By the way, did I say sorry that this is the David Byrne musical, Here Lies Love? I'm not sure I said it. Seattle Repertory Theater.
Right.
Sorry.
David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. It is billed as an immersive spectacle unlike anything you've ever seen. It is that. I think in terms of the subject matter, it is a sensitive chapter about repression and martial law and a period of contemporary history that unfortunately a lot of us don't remember. I remember reading about it in the New York Times. I was in college at the time. And I think you approach the story, you realize that it is a controversial figure. But the newsreels, they use news footage. So you get that element of student protest. You see this rise of this woman from this girl from a peasant to the first lady of the Philippines. And you see how she used her power and she seduced her people and sort of the ramifications. And I think it does pull history. It makes you think aware of history and a chapter in history that you might not have otherwise thought about.
Marcy, what do you think about in Here Lies Love, maybe the Infinity Mirrors? What do you feel like Sam and Seattle Rep would like our audiences to walk away with?
Well, first of all, I think they'd like audiences. And
yes.
I think above all, it's about gathering together to see things live and in person. That's something, I mean, we have the internet for every possible thing, but I think we are all craving being together. So Infinity Mirrors, we're together with our infinite selves, but also the people who have come at that same time that we have our tickets. Here Lies Love, most definitely a person-to-person experience. You are, you know, body shoulder to shoulder with your audience members, your co-audience members. It's about the shared experience. And I think just reminding people that you know, with all the stuff going on in the world, art has the power to be a refuge, to be an escape, but, you know, a place where we can come together.
That is our show. Will you please come back and soon?
I would love that.
Okay. We've been talking about Here Lies Love running through the 18th of June now. It's been extended until Sunday the 18th, and Infinity Mirrors opens June 30th. Sam releasing some limited tickets each day. First come, first serve. You can line up early to try and snag one when the museum opens at 10. KUOW's arts reporter, Marcy Silman, Crosscut's managing editor, Florangela Davila. Great to see you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.